From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, coming to you from 1540 WADK Newport. I'll talk on all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business, along with the business of politics and sports. The man who changed the world but deemed a failure in his own country, presiding over the collapse of the Soviet Union. We're looking at the legacy of Gorbachev on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. William Taubman is the Bertrand Snell Professor of Political Science Emeritus at Amherst College. His bio of Khrushchev won the Pulitzer Prize, and his seminal new book, Gorbachev, His Life and Times. And we welcome with honor Professor Taubman, and it's our first guest from Amherst. I went to Tufts, so we've competed against you guys.
Well, it's nice to talk to a jumbo.
Very good. Just as a big picture start, did he change the world? Did he fail?
Both. he changed his country, but not as much as he wished, and he changed the world, but it, like his country, has more or less lapsed back, at least partway into the situation that he changed.
I would say more than partway. Was he too conservative trying to reform, or was he too fast trying to change a culture?
You know, I've talked to him many times, 8 long interviews, and he has talked about being uncertain, both at the time and since, about whether he acted too fast or too slow. I think, in retrospect, he has decided he probably tried to act too fast, because he's learned that Russia cannot be democratized in the 5 or 6 years that he tried, and probably not even in decades. And at one point recently, Gorbachev said it may take the whole 21st century.
Wow. Would the Soviet Union, in your mind, have fallen of its own economic inertia regardless of the Gorbachev period?
I think the Soviet Union would have eventually collapsed. Whether it would have taken 10 years, 20, 25, 30, we don't know. But I think it would have collapsed, and if it had collapsed, or when it collapsed, it probably would have collapsed in a sea of blood, like most empires.
Yeah.
So in that sense, even though Gorbachev failed to democratize it, he nonetheless presided over its end in a relatively nonviolent, bloodless way.
You talk about that he feels it may take the whole century. Is the issue that Russia just has to have, or is comfortable with, autocrats from the era of the czars on up to the latest version, Putin?
Well, if you look through its history, you see centuries of authoritarianism,
yeah,
and then almost one century of totalitarianism under the Soviets, and 7 months, perhaps, of chaotic democracy in 1917, and then 3 or 4 years under Gorbachev. So the weight of tradition and habit is just overwhelming.
You wrote The Life and Times of Khrushchev as well. How do you compare and contrast them?
Well, Khrushchev started what Gorbachev tried to finish. Khrushchev started reforms. He denounced Stalin. Mm-hmm. There was a thaw in culture under his rule. But then he got scared and retreated. And even as he was retreating, he was kicked out. Gorbachev came in much better educated, much more sophisticated, much more ambitious, and went far beyond what Khrushchev had tried to do, only to be thwarted in the end himself.
Do you give the primary credit for ending the Cold War to Gorbachev, to Reagan, or again, inevitable?
Well, I think they both contributed, but I give the primary credit to Gorbachev, and I have a way of trying to sum that up, and this is it. I say, let's imagine that there was Gorbachev, but no Reagan. I think the Cold War would have ended because somebody like George Bush the First, as he eventually did after Reagan, would have warmed up to Gorbachev and they would have ended the Cold War. Now imagine reverse the situation. Imagine Reagan, but no Gorbachev.
Interesting.
I think the Cold War would have gone on because Reagan would never have had a partner. Who would have been the Soviet leader? Somebody like Ligachev or Romanov, one of the other troglodytes in the Kremlin, and the Cold War would have continued.
For those that are maybe younger, the terms perestroika and glasnost, what exactly do they mean in the context of Gorbachev's usage of them?
Well, perestroika literally means restructuring, and glasnost literally means openness. But Gorbachev gave them a far more expansive meaning. Perestroika, for him, became an attempt to transform the Soviet system, and in the end, he did destroy the communist regime. And Glasnost, starting out as an effort to create greater transparency about government actions, eventually became free speech, or almost entirely free speech.
The question on Perestroika that destroyed the Communist Party, was that his intent?
Not originally.
Yeah.
No, he came in hoping to modernize the Soviet Union, make it more efficient and somewhat more humane. But when he began with moderate economic reforms and they didn't produce much in the way of results, he resolved to break what he took to be the resistance of the Communist Party. And in the end, he broke the party itself. Now, I don't think this was only a response to the resistance to his initial reforms, because if you look back over his life, as I do in my book, you see that he had been evolving a kind of worldview which was close to what the Prague Spring had attempted. That is, communism, or, as he would have put it, socialism with a human face. And that really amounted to transforming the Soviet system and hobbling, crippling the Communist Party.
Interesting. I'm going to put Gorbachev on the couch now. One of the things that's always fascinated me in the business world is someone like a Jack Welch works his way up 30 years in General Electric, gets the CEO job, and then basically blows up the company. Gorbachev has similar, worked his way through the system. What is the psychology of how he was able to do that?
Well, this takes me several chapters to explain in the book, but I'll try to boil it down. I think it begins with a childhood which is really remarkable. He grew up in terrible times, born in 1931. Famine, collectivization, world war, Nazis occupy his village. Both grandfathers sent to the gulag. I mean, a total horrible era. But he emerges from it as a young man with confidence, self-esteem, optimism about the future, and trust in other people. And that then comes to the fore once he has power. He has the belief in himself. He believes he can change his country, and he trusts his fellow citizens to make democracy work. Now, I don't say that that automatically follows from that childhood, because there are lots of stages in between, Moscow University, climbing the party ladder. But you can see this character evolving as the years go by to the point where he dares to try to change his country and the world.
Well said. Is he bitter that he's so hated in his country and revered in the world? Is he at peace with it?
Well, he doesn't like to admit that, but I think you can see it. I mean, one thing he's done is decided to stay on and live and die in his own country. Mm-hmm. He could have moved to Germany. They would have welcomed him with open arms. He could have moved to the United States, but he's staying on, and it's a kind of stubborn determination to show that he is not abandoning his country, even when, in a very real sense, his country has abandoned him.
Yeah, I think you say in the book even his daughter did move to Germany.
Yeah, that is particularly sad, because throughout his life, his wife, dear wife Raisa, was always by his side. Even when she became ill, she insisted on traveling with him. And then after she died, his daughter either lived with him or lived next to him and traveled with him, taking on the role of his wife in that sense. And if now she spends most of her time in Germany, what does that mean? He's alone in a big empty house outside of Moscow with a couple of bodyguards and chauffeurs and chefs. And it pains me even to think about it.
And in fact, that was going to be my next question as we finish off the last minute and a half here is, how important was she as a partner? No other Soviet wives were even seen. And you also describe him in the book at her death as him saying that he's guilty, he did her in. Talk about that.
Yes, this is a very sad thing. She dies of leukemia in 1999, and he says, I am guilty, I did her in. I think what that means is that he led her into a life for which she was temperamentally not suited. She appeared to be She was a beautiful, sophisticated woman, the first real first lady the Soviet Union had ever had, after a bunch of women who sort of looked like tea cozies. They were grandmas, babushki. So she appeared to fit the role, but in fact, she took everything very hard. She was much more sensitive than he to criticism of him as well as her. And she had a stroke during the abortive coup against him in August 1991.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. We'll be back for the next segment. We'll look at the rise of the dirt poor farm boy from the Stalinist era. And we're back with Bill Taubman. He's written a definitive new bio on Gorbachev. And in looking back, you touched on it briefly. He was the son of peasants, and you describe him winning the high school Stalin Award, and he ends up, as you call him, the grave digger of the Soviet Union. Talk a little bit about those motivating factors. In particular, does growing up on a collectivized farm, did that show him why the incentives don't work if the stuff isn't privately owned and that kind of thing that drives some of his behavior?
Yes. At one point when he left his village and moved to Moscow University, he and a dear friend of his, whom I'll tell you about in a minute, were watching a movie about collective farmers. This is an oxymoron, a Stalinist musical comedy, and it showed the joyful farmers bringing in the harvest and the joyful milkmaids buying magnificent fabrics to make beautiful dresses. And Gorbachev leans over and whispers to his friend, it's a lie. It's brute force that makes them work, and there's nothing to buy in the stores. So he knew very well what the collective farms were like, and he knew that in the long run they needed an alternative they needed monetary incentives rather than sheer terror to make people work.
How is it that he comes across as such a moral straight arrow, and he goes up through the party, which is full of apparatchiks, drunks, you know, lazy folks, just, you know, trying to get by?
I think in the end he was too decent for his own country. I guess any politician has to cut corners at various times, and Gorbachev did cut corners in his time, but to be a man who shrank back at the thought of shedding blood, who tried as hard as he could never to use force, and to try to run a country like the Soviet Union with this kind of mentality was probably doomed. I mean, this is a country that had shed oceans of blood in the course of its existence. So he was too good. He was too decent.
Reminded me of Jimmy Carter in that way, by the way, the too decent.
I don't think he was the prude or the Jimmy Carter was, but he was a good man, and I've spent a lot of time in the Russian provinces, both when I was researching my book on Khrushchev and then again on Gorbachev, and I've met some of the kind of people that Gorbachev worked with as he climbed the greasy communist pole, and they are pretty hard to believe. I remember one time, when I was working on Khrushchev, I was in the city of Donetsk, which is now famous for being a battlefield between Russia and Ukraine. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting there with some Russian bureaucrats or Ukrainian bureaucrats, and they were drinking vodka as if out of a water hose. And before my very eyes, they started chasing waitresses around the restaurant and into the kitchen. I was utterly appalled. But this is the way most of them were. They were amoral, they were corrupt, and Gorbachev was not. He was honest and incorruptible.
Amazing. So how is it that he ends up, he gets very close, Brezhnev trusts him, confides in him, he gets close to Andropov, who's the ex-KGB guy, and Chernenko. These are the three guys that ran the stagnating part of the era when they were dying off left and right. How does he get close to all of them and basically gets pulled up?
Well, the fascinating irony is that his very virtues, Gorbachev's very virtues, made him attractive to them. They were old, they were cynical, but they had once been idealists, and they knew that their country was in trouble. And they suddenly saw this young communist rising star who reminded them of what their idealism had originally been about. I think they were pleasantly surprised, perhaps even amazed, and decided that someone like him ought to be promoted and eventually made the leader of their country.
Fascinating. Did he fundamentally get caught between the reformers and the hardliners, sort of in that middle area?
Absolutely. He got caught between communist hardliners on the one side, and on the other side, radical Democrats. That is, Democrats who wanted to move his reforms faster than he did. Yeltsin eventually became their leader. On the other side, the hardliners eventually conspired against him and put him under house arrest in August 1991. And Gorbachev, true to his character, tried to reconcile them. But in effect, what he was trying to do was reconcile the irreconcilables, and they wouldn't follow him. He believed in consensus. They were determined to fight. He believed in compromise. They thought that was a dirty word and a sign of weakness.
Interesting. Shouldn't he have tried harder, or shouldn't Yeltsin and him have been allies?
I think he and Yeltsin would have been a mighty team if they had only been able to cooperate, because they both shared certain ideals. They both wanted reforms. They both wanted to democratize Russia. But they had different styles, which would have complemented each other. Gorbachev was calculated and calm. Yeltsin was a sort of populist, explosive, impulsive. Yeltsin would have appealed to masses who thought Gorbachev was weak and indecisive. Gorbachev appealed to intellectuals who thought Yeltsin was a loose cannon. But they couldn't bring it off. They couldn't cooperate. And worse than that, they hated each other and undermined each other. And one of the sad things about Gorbachev's story is that if you look very closely at their relationship, you see that Gorbachev, in effect, contributes to creating Yeltsin as his gravedigger by humiliating him, which Yeltsin then returns in spades.
Interesting. And Gorbachev, initially, he focuses on law and order and anti-alcohol before the consumer benefits and improving the standard of living. That was a mistake, too, wasn't it?
It certainly was. At the time it seemed sensible, because Russia has been plagued throughout its existence with alcoholism, and the statistics showed all kinds of horrible results of the alcoholism. And more than that, both Gorbachev and his wife had brothers who drank themselves, in effect, to death. Hmm. So it was quite natural that they started in this way, but it was it went too far. As things always go too far in Russia, the people down below, the lackeys below the boss, carried it out to extremes. In the Soviet Union, the sale of vodka provided a large portion of the state budget, so suddenly the budget was in trouble as a result of the anti-alcohol campaign. In a sense, the anti-alcohol campaign was the legacy of the old way of doing things, and so Gorbachev started out not with economic reforms, not with democratizing the country. He started out with the old-fashioned notion of prohibition.
All right, we got about a minute to go. Describe the coup. I mean, you talk about phone lines being cut and Raisa having a stroke. Tell us about the coup.
Well, Gorbachev and Raisa were at their villa on the edge of the Black Sea at the bottom of Crimea. He was taking a vacation a few days before he was to sign the new Union Treaty, which would create a new non-Soviet Union. That was a mistake, because one afternoon the phones went dead, and suddenly a delegation from Moscow arrived and confronted him with a choice: either join us in reversing your reforms or stay here under what amounted to house arrest. And he chose to defy them. They put him under house arrest. He and his wife feared for their lives. They survived, but basically their government, their reform plan, their dreams did not survive more than several months after the attempted coup.
Listening with Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll get to Gorbachev on the world stage next. We're back with William Taubman. He's got a book, Garbage Off His Life and Times. He's been working on it since 2005, and it's just out. In this segment, we'll look at Gorbachev on the world stage. So I got to start with Margaret Thatcher, who was a right-wing revolutionary in her own way, but she felt she could do business with him, right?
Yes, she was the one who decided, even before he became the Soviet leader, she decided in 1984, after he visited London, that she could do business with him. And she immediately got on the phone and called Reagan and urged him to try to do business with Gorbachev.
You couldn't think of two less likely people that would revolutionize the world in terms of trying to abolish nuclear weapons than Reagan and somebody out of the Soviet Empire. Where did it, on Gorbachev's part, where did this desire to abolish nuclear weapons come from?
Well, the first thing that Gorbachev understood from the start of his reign was that if the Soviet Union was to reform itself, there had to be peace. He had to ease the Cold War and actually try to end it. Because as long as there was a Cold War, he couldn't get away with shifting resources to civilian uses. He couldn't get away with easing controls at home in a hostile world. So that was the first thing he set out to do. But he also understood very well what a nuclear war would mean and wanted, if at all possible, to banish the possibility of that. And lo and behold, it turned out that Ronald Reagan, who had appeared to be a scourge of communism and had called the Soviet Union an evil empire, lo and behold, Ronald Reagan turned out to be the perfect partner for Gorbachev. They didn't know that right away, but they discovered it pretty quickly.
And he had in his mind, and both of them, I guess, if they'd signed the deal, that in 86, that there'd be no nukes by 2000. Is that, by the way, fundamentally naive and also risky with terrorists and stuff being left? And I know Thatcher felt that strongly.
Well, I think it was certainly naive in the sense that the world wasn't ready for that. In fact, neither country was. In fact, neither leadership group was ready for it. They almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons at Reykjavik in 1986. But if they had agreed, Reagan would have gone back to Washington and discovered that his Joint Chiefs of Staff and his cabinet thought that was a crazy idea. And I don't think Gorbachev's colleagues liked it either. But, you know, I'd like to add this, that even as they agreed on something as important as that, I think it was the personal chemistry between them that initially created the bond. And in my book, I talk about all the things they surprisingly turned out to have in common. They both came from small towns. They were both optimistic. They were both upbeat about the future. They both trusted things to turn out well. Even their marriages resembled each other, because Nancy Reagan and Raisa Gorbachev were really two of a kind, very sensitive about their husband's welfare, nervous about their husband's coming under criticism, insecure. And as a result, they turned out to be hostile to each other. But the similarities between their husbands created a personal bond. Don't ask me to explain. That may be a contradiction, but nonetheless, I think it's a fact.
Fascinating insight. So Gorbachev said that he would accept 50% cut in strategic. He would take the double zero option, not even in intermediate forces in Europe. He would allow SDI in the lab. How close do you think they came, and why was SDI such a hang-up?
SDI, you know, as I reflected on this, I realized SDI was like a kind of science fiction phantom.
Yeah.
Because it made possible, or it seemed to make possible, the abolition of nuclear weapons, because Reagan thought SDI made nuclear weapons irrelevant, or would eventually make nuclear weapons irrelevant. So that prepared him to agree to abolish them. But SDI struck Gorbachev and the Soviets as a weapon in itself, which might make it impossible for them to retaliate, and thus would vitiate the whole strategy of deterrence. So it was as if the science fiction phantom of SDI, on the one hand gave, and the other hand taketh away. It gave the possibility, provided the possibility of eliminating nuclear weapons, and then made it impossible to do so.
If we move to Helmut Kohl now and the whole German reunification, How do you think Gorbachev handled that? And he was criticized for, you know, quote, letting Eastern Europe go, and then the German reunification, and then NATO expanding into Eastern Europe, and on and on.
Well, Gorbachev's handling of Eastern Europe and Germany looks on the surface very puzzling. And it looked very puzzling at the time to the Americans and the Germans. Puzzling in the sense that they never expected Gorbachev to agree as quickly and as readily to the reunification of Germany. And they certainly didn't expect Gorbachev to agree that a unified Germany could remain in NATO. And yet he agreed to both. He allowed the East European allies, former satellites, to break away from the Soviet Union. So this is a mystery. What explains it? In my view, one of the things that explains it is that Gorbachev had a kind of idealistic dream, image of the future of Europe in which it would come together, East and West, in what he called a common European home. That sounds like propaganda, but he was deadly serious about it. He imagined that the East Europeans might break from communism, but they wouldn't break from the Warsaw Pact. As the Warsaw Pact, that is the counterpart to NATO, began to crumble, he thought, well, that isn't the end of the world either, because if East and West Europe converge, if NATO disappears as well, all of Europe can live in peace. So this was the kind of idealistic dream that underlay his calm when East Europe began to break away and his willingness to see both the reunification of Germany and its remaining in NATO. In retrospect, this too looks naive because we know that NATO has not disappeared. It has expanded all the way to the borders of Russia, taking in all or almost all of Eastern Europe, the Baltic states as well. It's even considered expanding into Ukraine and Georgia. So this is another area where Gorbachev had a wonderful hope for the world, but it didn't work out the way he dreamed.
It's just more amazing that he got to the position he got to with this level of idealism. What did he think of Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall?
Well, that I think Reagan's got a lot of credit for that, as if his very words led to the collapse of the wall. That's not really the case. What led to the collapse of the wall were the changes in East Germany and in Eastern Europe, the liberalization, the unrest. That, in turn, was triggered by the changes in Russia, in the Soviet Union. Of course, the East Europeans contributed to their own liberation, but Gorbachev allowed them to do so. Reagan is out there on the edge with those wonderful words, but Gorbachev didn't tear down the wall. The Germans did. And Gorbachev, I think, deserves the credit for allowing the whole process to begin.
Now, the Soviets were in Afghanistan and failed miserably. We've been in Afghanistan, and you wouldn't say we've been too successful. Did Gorbachev have that right, too, getting out?
Well, when Gorbachev came in, I learned he had a little to-do list in his vest pocket. And the top of the list was exit from Afghanistan. When you look back at it, your first reaction is to say, why did it take them so long to get out? But now look at us. We've been there since, what, 2003? And there's no end in sight? So what I originally thought was Gorbachev's slowness to get out turns out to be speed. And we may never get out ourselves.
Yeah. You know, Reagan, you know, called them the evil empire and then, you know, sits down with Gorbachev. Does Reagan get the credit for overcoming his evil empire or sort of view, or you're saying that Gorbachev was what basically facilitated with their personal relationship?
Well, I think Reagan deserves a lot of credit, and you can see it by looking closely at Reagan and his talks with Gorbachev, their interaction, their agreements, their meeting of the minds, their personal bonding. But there's another bit of evidence, and that is, when George Bush comes in 1989, he tells Gorbachev, when they meet at Governor's Island in New York in December 1988, that he's going to pick up and continue Reagan's policies. Reagan, meanwhile, has said, evil empire, that was another era, that was another time. But what does Bush do? He steps back, he retreats, he declares a pause, and months go by before they resume the kind of relationship that Gorbachev had with Reagan. I think that this was very unfortunate because this was a moment when Gorbachev was doing well, was still popular. he could have benefited at home from signing the Strategic Arms Agreement with the United States, which in fact was delayed until 1991. But Bush, and especially people around him like Cheney and Scowcroft and Robert Gates, turn out to have told Bush, well, in effect, Gorbachev may be another smiley-faced communist. Is he for real? Is he lulling our vigilance with his... Is he smothering us with kindness? Scowcroft said that. So I think all of that shows that Reagan saw the light, at least as I understand it, and it took Bush almost a year to see it again.
Interesting. And you get the feeling in your book that that Gorbachev's really personally hurt by that sort of interregnum delay that Bush put in. We're coming from our flagship stations, WGCH, Greenwich, Yale Radio, WYBC, and we'll be back with our final national segment, The Gorbachev Legacy, next. Our guest, Russian historian William Taubman. We're back for our final national segment. And, Bill, in the Gorbachev legacy, where do you put him? There's Reagan's, Thatcher's, there's Nixon, who dealt with architectural, you know, world order architecture. Where do you put him?
Well, I view him in the end as a tragic hero. Hero in the sense that he destroys the last gasp of totalitarianism in the Soviet Union. He transforms the system. He destroys the Communist Party. He creates the groundwork for democracy in the future by allowing free elections and creates a functioning parliament instead of a rubber stamp. He ends the Cold War. He reduces the danger of a nuclear holocaust. He does all of these heroic things, and yet it ends badly. And it ends badly in part because it was such an impossible task to begin with, but he contributes to the bad end by his own fatal flaws. He's too confident. He's overconfident. He reaches so high that he overreaches. And in that sense, one has to say that he is a tragic hero in that he not only fails, but that his own fatal flaws contribute to that outcome. I think at the end of the day, the main reason for the failure was the unyielding nature of Russia itself. But he contributed to that outcome. Now, we'd have to look at those other leaders you mentioned and see how many of them were capable of the heroic achievements that Gorbachev was, how many of them contributed to their own failings in the end through their own fatal flaws. I think on the whole, Gorbachev is a magnificent failure, is a way to put it. And I'm not sure Nixon is a magnificent failure, but that kind of comparison I leave to others.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to end with this, but it fits with what you're saying, a magnificent failure. I kind of see it as Gorbachev succeeded by failing, and Putin has failed by succeeding.
You know, Gorbachev himself has had an odd relationship to Putin. He's been much more favorable toward Putin than one might expect. He's criticized him very severely at times. He compares Putin's political party, United Russia, to the Communist Party under Brezhnev. But on the other hand, I know Gorbachev supported Putin in the year 2000 when he ran first for president. He opposed him in 2012. I think the main thing is that Gorbachev has decided that Russia needs a certain amount of authoritarianism, that it may take a long time for Russia to get beyond that. And so for the time being, Putin sort of fills the bill, although he goes too far.
Wow.
And I'd say one more thing. Putin has been very nasty to the West, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
And Gorbachev has praised Putin's foreign policy. Gorbachev himself says now that the West tore down what he was trying to build, and that after he left power, the West tore us down, looted us. I think Gorbachev feels betrayed by the West. And I don't know this for sure, but I speculate that when Gorbachev sees Putin giving the West such a hard time, he may very well feel that the West deserves it.
That's interesting, because I just see Putin is so corrupt, and he has people killed, and we know on, and it seems so different from Gorbachev. So let me ask this question. Does he not understand the nature of power? I mean, Putin seems to understand power. He buys off the oligarchs. He shuts down the media. He has people killed, literally, if he feels this. Did Gorbachev not understand the nature of power, and particularly within Russia?
I think that is a fair hypothesis, but it has to be paired with the understanding that Gorbachev was a magnificent tactician when it came to destroying the old system. Mm-hmm. Where he failed was in creating a new one. I mean, how did he get the communist hardliners to vote themselves out of office, which is essentially what he got them to do? He got the Politburo to approve his reforms. He got them to do that by manipulating them, maneuvering them, by taking advantage of party discipline, by making them feel as that if they crossed him, they were threatening the system itself. So he did a brilliant job at that maneuvering, that Machiavellian maneuvering to destroy the old system. But when he tried to create a new one, a democratic one, with elections and all the rest, he didn't do as well. And along came Yeltsin, who did better, and along came Putin, who hasn't reestablished totalitarianism, but he has established at least the kind of authoritarianism that Russia has known for so long.
Does he get credit now on the other side of the success part of the ledger for some sort of new world order, reducing nuclear threat, ending Cold War, getting out of office without being killed?
Well, it depends how you view the old war versus the new Cold War, Cold War versus the new one. I think the old one was more dangerous, and he ended it. The new one is pretty scary. It's awful in new technological ways. But I don't think that Putin and the weakened, ruling over the weakened Russia with a GNP the size of Portugal's is as dangerous as the Soviet Union was as a kind of flawed superpower. So in that sense, Gorbachev ended a more dangerous era, even though he didn't create the kind of new era that he wanted, and instead we've lapsed back at least part way.
Tell us how he's doing now. Has he read your book? What's his health, etc.?
He doesn't read English, so he hasn't read the book yet, although I did send it to him. And I got word back from one of his people that he thanks me from the heart, but he says once the Russian edition comes out, he will read it, and then he will give me his impressions. And I'm waiting for those with not quite knowing what to expect, because although the book is admiring, it is quite critical of him at many junctures. And as we all know, I think the thought of a biography is scary to anyone, and we would all hope that if anyone writes our biography, we would want it to turn out as praising as possible, and we'll see what he thinks of mine.
As we finish off now, in the book you quote Raisa saying, it turns out you have to die to be understood. Is that going to be the same with her husband?
I think it is. I think it is. I imagine that when Gorbachev finally dies, there will be a moment, maybe two or three moments, in which Russians appreciate him and feel nostalgic and praise him. But I think in the long run, well, in the middle run, they'll probably return so many of them who missed the strong hand when he tried to be reasonable. In the middle run, many of them will regret him again. In the long, long run, my hope is that Russia will still become democratic as the middle class enlarges and gets more active. And in the long, long run, I hope Gorbachev will be seen with the respect in Russia that he deserves.
Now, let's hope you're right about the long run. Thanks to Bill Tallman. That book is Gorbachev, His Life and Times. It will become the definitive account of Gorbachev's light. Our next show, we've got Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein. She's going to talk about the economic decline of a small Midwestern town and how it's emblematic of middle-class unrest with Trump. Thanks to William Tallman. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody next Monday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.